Chairman Ritchie, good morning, and commissioners, good morning. It's Mike Gerber. I think we have, I just want to verify that we all have all five of our commissioners present. Mr. Chairman, are you on?
Yes, Carl? I am.
Okay. Commissioner Bailey?
Here.
Commissioner Carrington?
Present.
Commissioner Apostolo?
Present.
And Commissioner Duncan Hall? Commissioner Duncan Hall?
Present.
Okay, great. So we've confirmed that all five commissioners are here. Commissioner Ritchie, Chairman Ritchie, whenever you'd like to start.
All right. Mike, will you proceed with the roll call for the two board meetings?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, we're going to be opening up the Housing Authority of the City of Austin, as well as Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. Commissioner Bailey?
Here.
Commissioner Carrington?
Present.
Commissioner Duncan Hall?
Present.
Commissioner Apostolo? Commissioner Apostolo?
Present.
And Chairman Ritchie?
Present.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum present for both of you.
So we are officially called to order at 12:01 p.m. on Thursday, April 16th. For the Housing Authority of the City of Austin Board of Commissioners, as well as for the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. So we have certified there's a quorum. At this time, I will ask for a moment of silence in honor of our fellow resident who is passed away last week, Felicia Vargas. She was the chairperson of the Citizens Advisory Committee. So I'd ask at this time for one moment of silence in recognition of her. All right. At this time, we will proceed with our meeting pursuant to the governor's emergency declaration. The portions of the Open Meetings Act that requires a quorum to be established by a majority of the members meeting in person, that has been suspended, and we are allowed to meet pursuant to the exception of the Open Records Act, Open Meetings Act, to have a teleconference meeting. I believe the line is open for members of the general public. The way we will conduct this meeting, we will go through each item. Before we take a vote on an item, we will provide an opportunity for a member of the public who may be listening in to comment before we take action. So with that, Mike, I will ask if there are any other housekeeping details we need to take care of before we get started.
No, sir. I think we can proceed.
All right. So the first item will be with the Housing Authority of the City of Austin Board of Commissioners meeting. We will go to the consent agenda. We have one item on the consent agenda, and that is to approve the board minutes from the summary of the board minutes from the board meeting held on March 26, 2020. At this time, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
This is Edwina. So move.
There's a motion by Commissioner Carrington. Is there a second?
I second. Apostolo.
There's a seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. And now we will have discussion. Is there any member of the general public who is listening in at this meeting who would like to make a comment at this time? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And we will move on to item number two, which is an update on the agency's actions related to the coronavirus for Residence and Client Support Center.
Commissioner Ritchie and Chair, yep. Sylvia, I'll let you go ahead and present.
Sorry about that. Mr. Gerber, yes, good afternoon, commissioners, staff, and guests. My name is Sylvia Blanco, Chief Operating Officer for the Housing Authority. And I just wanted to, if you can, turn your attention to item number 2 in your board books. It's several pages worth of measures that the Housing Authority has taken, as well as its subsidiaries, to ensure continuity of operations and also to ensure that we are staying in very close contact with our residents and clients. So you can see by department, this has obviously touched every facet of our organization and subsidiaries, and you can see the measures that have been taken by each and every department. As you can imagine, the majority of our staff is working remotely, and we do have a number of essential employees continuing to come in and ensure continuity in terms of mail incoming and outgoing, ensuring that the properties are still being maintained. We are still actively completing make-ready units at all of our properties, and we are working with our residents and clients to ensure that we are being very responsive to any income changes in light of many, many residents being impacted economically. So we are contacting them by phone, by email, and acting very responsively to any of those changes so we can ensure that their rents are being changed accordingly. And that is within assisted housing as well as within our low-income housing departments. So we are also implementing, for example, in admissions, going to a virtual eligibility processing so that we continue to bring in families that are in need of our housing assistance. And in assisted housing, we are also doing a virtual inspection process that's being kicked off for initial inspections to continue new move-ins. And with Austin Pathways and Community Development, they have launched a resident and client support center that is open Monday through Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. And it also allows for bilingual needs. This is for residents and clients who are experiencing distress, isolation, and are needing resources, information to navigate programs and assistance. So we are there for a compassionate ear. And we'll get into a few more data points on the Resident and Client Support Center. But that has been a huge help to many of our residents who are experiencing a lot of distress and uncertainty during these challenging times. On the communication side, as you can imagine, Ken Bodden has been very busy ensuring that we're keeping our information up to date on our website and through social media channels. We're putting a lot of signage and flyers and posters up at every property to keep them informed of changing circumstances and letting folks know that certain amenities have to be closed at this time due to the stay-at-home orders. Finance has been working with various stakeholders, our vendors, to go paperless and ensure that we have a direct deposit process in place so there's continuity of payments. HR has also been very, very busy with connecting with all of our staff, making sure that all of our benefits were in place for the kickoff of the new fiscal year. There's an essential duty letter that was drafted to ensure that those essential staff coming in to work was not going to get in trouble by the authorities. We're also in operations and procurement, ensuring that bulk trash is still running as usual. We've got procurement also ensuring that we have the supplies in place for personal protective equipment and other supplies for disinfecting and sanitizing all of our properties and common areas to ensure the minimizing of any exposure. Planning and development, Jimmy's team has still continued to work from home on any projects. While some of them have been put on hold, we are still working with vendors and contractors to get some projects lined up as soon as it is safe to proceed. And QC, Kelly's team has been ensuring that we've got compliance investigations going, as well as the CMAP review, which will be presented later on this call. And also working to get some appeal hearings going through our compliance department. So Henrietta Washington, our hearings officer, will kick those off. And so we've got a lot going. Southwest Housing is also ensuring that the MOR process is going to await a modified MOR format from HUD before we move forward with that. And a lot of Michael's team is assisting with, for example, the Resident and Client Support Center and some other key projects that we've been needing some assistance with, including a software implementation project for the Yardi software, as well as some other high-profile projects. So we're very fortunate to have them on hand to assist. And TMI, last but definitely not least, Andrea's team has done an outstanding job in mobilizing our workforce to work remotely in a very, very short amount of time. And that has included increasing the agency's capacity for virtual private networks from 100 users to 150, and also increasing the agency's internet speed from 100 megabytes to 500. So that has definitely helped with our continuity of operations. So those are the high points. And if you have any specific questions, I'm happy to field those. And Mike, did you want to touch on the Resident and Client Support Center overview, or did you want me to handle that?
No. If I think Pilar is on, and if you don't mind, we'll let Pilar highlight for that section.
And Mike, this is Carl. Excuse me, call me with a full mouth. Before we proceed, can you identify from the staff who's all on the call as well?
I sure can. We've got Ann Gass, Jimmy Teasdale, Lisa Garcia, Martha Roth, Michael Cummings, Nydia Hirams, Pilar Sanchez, Ron Kowal, Suzanne Schwertner, and our counsel, Wilson Stoker. Is there any staff that I missed? Andrea Galloway, of course.
Andrea, yeah.
Okay, so that's
did you mention, I'm sorry, Bill Walter is also on the call?
I'm sorry, Bill Walter from Coates Rose is on the call as well, and he'll kick in when we start talking about AHC projects. But
okay, go ahead,
Pilar is sure, Pilar Sanchez is overseeing the Resident and Client Support Center. And Pilar, would you give about a two-minute update on what's going on there?
Sure. We launched the support center on March 25th. And for the first 14 business days, we've received over 300 calls from residents, and we have made over 1,500 calls out, reaching out to residents to inform them of the center, to check in on them, to remind them of food boxes coming in or for specific announcements for their property. The Bringing Health Home team has also had a special project in this regard. They are calling all the clients at Booker T. Washington, where their program has piloted, and they have conducted over 65 COVID-19 assessments, and they're prioritizing the families or the individuals that they know of that have a chronic disease. And they're providing those individuals customized information, education, referrals, and even some medical supplies or equipment where needed. And then they've also taken the lead on reaching out to any families that have tested positive that we know of. We have 5 families so far at our properties, and so they're reaching out to them, calling them every day to remind them to stay isolated, and they're providing them assistance. For example, delivering a food box to their door, delivering a oxygen saturation monitor, a thermometer, or things like that.
Thank you, Pilar. Please go ahead. Commissioner, if you just state your name,
yeah,
so we have it on the record again.
I know a lot of people have questions. Okay, hold on, let's go, because I think I heard Commissioner Apostola, I think I heard Commissioner Bailey. I've got some comments I want to make as well. So, Commissioner Apostola, go ahead, and then Commissioner Bailey.
Okay, my question to Pilar is, the testing, is it being done at all the properties or just BTW?
We're not conducting testing. What we're doing is we're conducting a verbal assessment, basically asking them about their conditions, about their specific needs. So it's a more of a survey versus testing. The testing is only done off-site by health organizations.
But this is at all properties?
The survey that we're conducting is only at BTW, where our Bringing Home Health team works.
Okay.
So this is Rodolfo and one of our community health workers that's a resident that is still engaged in that project. We focused a lot on Chalmers and BTW, and when COVID-19 hit, they've transferred their work into surveying those folks with chronic health conditions and making sure that as they prepare to deal with COVID-19, that they can have access to resources and that we have a good sense of what their needs might be and can get them connected to community care or to integral care or to other healthcare providers in the area. And I should say to the board also, just by way of backdrop, we have had positive tests of COVID-19 now at Rosewood, BTW, Northgate, and Meadowbrook. So there are at least 4, maybe 5 cases of testing positive for COVID-19.
Commissioner Apostolo, with those cases, we are serving the families at other properties if they tested positive.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Bailey, Commissioner Apostolo, do you have any more questions?
No, sir.
Commissioner Bailey, I think I heard you trying to get in.
You probably heard me mentally trying to get in.
I got
2 quick questions, and one I talked to Mike about yesterday, and that's our senior properties. And Pilar, I guess you're running the front end of that program. What concerns me is every day I get up and I see where a nursing home has just been wiped out by COVID-19, and I want to make sure that our senior properties are adequately being taken care of.
So I'll chime in on that, because while Pilar's team is doing a lot of calling in, our ability to provide other types of direct service is somewhat limited. We've done a lot of posters and a lot of you know, provided a lot of information to residents, and we do continue to have managers who report to Sylvia and property staff on the properties doing appropriate social distancing and, you know, staying in their offices, but they can still field phone calls. At our senior properties, we've also put in place security guards full-time, so 24/7. We felt like we needed that because we were concerned about, at those properties, people not adhering to the rules as readily as they were at other properties. And so the security guards have been helping to, you know, break up small groups and to keep people moving and not loitering in the hallways or in the areas that, you know, like the lobby or near the community rooms where they were formerly able to convene. It's very difficult for seniors because, you know, a routine for many of them was, you know, wake up in the morning, go downstairs, get a cup of coffee, that, you know, have a nice conversation, and then that flows into, you know, maybe a morning prayer group or to bingo or to a, you know, book club, and then into lunch. And so a lot of routine has been lost. And so the call center that Pilar heads up has done a great job of helping to deal with some of that isolation. Sylvia, anything else you'd chime in with?
Yes, I also wanted to add that we have removed congregant seating to also discourage the congregating that had been taking place. So we have removed a lot of that group seating. The other thing too is we, on top of maintenance, doing hourly or every other hour of sanitizing and wiping down of commonly touched surfaces in the common areas, we also have engaged a vendor to go in weekly and do a really deep sanitizing and disinfecting of those common areas. And this, of course, as you can imagine, is those are areas that we just cannot close down just because of the nature of the construction of the building. So elevators, hallways, common areas, the entry doorways, all of those are also getting additional deep disinfecting and sanitizing.
On the elevators, do we have a one person per elevator rule?
We have a two person per elevator rule.
Okay.
And of course, everyone should now be wearing masks in public spaces as well.
Right, right.
Commissioner Bailey.
Yes.
At our senior sites, we've had a lot of communication with our seniors. We had one resident call us and said that she needed to get tested. We monitored that, and she came back negative. And then at Lakeside, we had another one that got taken to the hospital by EMS, and they let us know that he tested negative. So the residents are communicating with us, letting us know what's going on, and we still have not had any positive reports at our senior sites. We're also going to be assigning one employee to our seniors and calling them on a routine basis to check in on them and to make sure that it's the same employee every time so that there's a relationship and trust built. So those are other things that we're working on.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I don't want to wake up one morning and see Lakeside has had 13 people die, and they asked us what we did, and we said we put some posters up. It sounds like y'all are on top of it, and that sets my mind at ease a little bit. And then I had one other question for Michael Cummings. We are on your report number 3. When we get phone calls from the residents, we're answering with voicemail. Can you explain to me why?
Sure, yeah. Again, this is Michael Cummings with Southwest Housing. And Andrea may have additional information, but we have a limitation in our phone system where under the work from home setting, we were getting direct calls or trying to get direct calls, but the duration of the call would drop the call after somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 seconds to a minute. As a result, you know, we use the voicemail system that they check quarterly every 15 minutes to check if a resident has left a voicemail and then call them back in that time frame. We are exploring, you know, we had one, there were two remedies we were trying to come up with to fix that. One was the increase in internet speed that Sylvia mentioned earlier. That didn't entirely solve the process. So we have now, kind of moved over to using, another system that, is successfully being used at Haka called Grasshopper, which I think will afford us that ability to get, the calls directly so that they, you know, if someone calls in real time, they're talking to a real person, but that the limitation came from the phone system limitations originally.
And just to clarify, Michael's call center, of course, is the call center for the project-based contract administrator work in Texas and Arkansas, and it receives a fairly low volume of calls. It's Michael, is it correct? I mean, it's you've received a total in Texas. I think you've gotten a total, just looking at the report, 21 general calls and 13 non-life-threatening calls. So whatever that totals in Texas. So anyone calling from Texas, and those numbers generally don't go up a whole lot. In fact, we've been seeing them decline. Those folks are getting their message heard within 15 minutes. For Arkansas last month, we only received two non-threatening, life-threatening calls and two general calls. So four, a total of four calls. So it's a fairly low call volume. And, whereas on the resident call center for Haka, those calls are being answered immediately, as best we can, we've got multiple people on the line at all times and we're trying our level best to answer all of them. On rare occasions, somebody's having to leave a message, but generally they're getting through to a live person. Is that fair to say, Michael?
Yeah. And yes, that's a good representation. And I think, you know, we're not getting on the SHCC call center for the Texas Arkansas properties a lot of COVID specific questions. As Mike alluded to, you know, because we're not the landlord, we usually don't get that kind of, I wouldn't call it first responder kind of, but that first response is usually to site management. And then, in most cases, those are resolved. If they're not, then we become their option to call. So, you know, as those numbers show, we haven't seen, you know, we haven't got a lot of COVID specific calls or a spike in number of calls, but Mike did accurately, describe the nature of those.
Well, the call volume answers my question. When we get ready to get our contracts renewed, I don't want somebody to pop up and have a whole bunch of complaints that we never answered phones. And so
that
answers that. And then my last point on Jimmy Teasdale stuff, it says majority of our large projects but are being deferred. What are we doing about just run-of-the-mill, commode stopped up, heating's not working, that type of a call-in? How are we handling that?
Do you want me to take that one?
Yeah, why don't you respond? Because you're dealing with the routine things through maintenance, and then Jimmy, you can talk about the larger issues. Go ahead.
Commissioner Bailey, in terms of in-unit emergency work orders, like a stopped-up toilet for a unit that only has one toilet, those are treated as emergencies, and they are getting addressed by the maintenance staff using personal protective equipment going into the unit. And in terms of routine, like say, you know, the mini blinds are need to be replaced, those for right now are on pause. And we do have record of it, and we will go back to those routine work orders. But for right now, we are addressing the true emergencies in the units. And it's being done through a combination of maintenance staff with personal protective equipment, or we also have a list of vendors that have been vetted through Jimmy Teasdale that can go into units, perform emergency work orders with the necessary personal protective equipment as well. So we have that as a backup.
Okay, thanks. And I'm okay about the large ones. Just go on as far as I'm concerned. We can move on.
Okay, great. Any other team members want to add anything?
Well, actually, I was letting all the other board members ask their questions first before I asked mine. So,
oh, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Is there anybody else that would like to ask a question to the staff? If not, then Mike, I want to just commend you and the team for comprehensive approach you've taken to address this issue, looking at every facet of the way we operate, making sure we have a plan in place, and we're specifically not just looking at on the operations side, but also looking at the care and well-being of our residents. That being said, I want to, and I'm not sure whether this is Pilar or Martha or Ken Bowden as well, but one of the things that struck me is that with our residents, some if not all of them will probably receive a stimulus check given their financial situation. And I just know from, you know, having lived in public housing, dealt with a lot of poor people in my life, usually what happens is when people come into a good portion of money right away, they may tend to go out and buy things that they want and they've been wanting and desiring for a very long time, as opposed to focusing on the things that they may need to address immediately. So it got me to thinking, I know that we have at one point in time dealt with Frost Bank, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'm on the advisory board at Frost Bank. But I know they have done some financial literacy with us. I think it would be good for us if we would reach out to them and see if there's some sort of webinar we could post on our website. Is there some sort of PowerPoint presentation, something so that when people get the stimulus checks, they understand sort of priorities that they need to take? Because, again, I know it's easy for somebody to get money and, you know, they can say, oh, well, I don't have to pay rent. Instead of paying rent, I'm going to go buy some electronic item, and all of a sudden the money's gone and they can't figure out, you know, what did I do with it when I really need to take care of some very important things. And so I think it would be a good idea for us to do something with financial literacy. And so I'm not sure if this is with Pilar, whether this is with Ken or with Martha. I know in the past, even before this, I did talk to Martha about financial literacy and online banking for our residents. So I do think this would be something we ought to look at to sort of help educate our residents. Because, again, having been in their position once in life, I just know how people have a tendency to go out and buy things when they get new money, things that they probably, in terms of learning sort of how to prioritize their spending. And that's really what the issue
sure.
is making sure that we do a good job of helping them understand the priorities. What that does do, it helps us as well, because to the extent they, you know, part of financial literacy, it teaches you pay your rent first, pay your utility bills first. To the extent that somebody may get a stimulus check and may be thinking about skipping to pay rent, this will reinforce them the need to pay rent so that if they ever, when they get out of public housing, they get in another situation, they understand kind of the basic things I need to take care of first in terms of what is priority, in terms of priority bills that need to be paid. So I'll leave that to you, Mike, and the team to figure out how we do that, but I just think it's a good idea. I've talked to other executive directors and other individuals around the country through NARO, and that was, and we talked about this, and everybody thought this was really a great idea that we all should be looking at implementing, working with our financial partners to help do financial literacy for our folks. Because just thinking through this, you could have somebody get a stimulus check, you could have somebody get an unemployment check. As I understand it, the unemployment is what, $600 for Texas, and I mean, you know, $300 for Texas, and then you have the $600 for the feds pop on. So you could go from getting $1,200 a month to almost $5,000 a month. And that's a lot of money for somebody who is not accustomed to handling that type of money on a monthly basis. And then on top of that, you could actually may qualify if you have a small business through and working through our business incubator. You may get a economic entry loan, which is basically a grant, and that's $10,000. So somebody could come into a lot of money, and I just want to make sure that if they are doing that, they understand how to prioritize their spending. We're not trying to be big brother and direct them, but I think the education and helping them will help them sort of make the right choices so they don't end up at the end of this with more debt than they had going into it.
We will ask Pilar and her team to provide some additional financial literacy resources. Leilani Vejas Lim had a lot of experience with working with our financial independence group and worked with a number of banks and had worked at a bank prior to coming to HACA. So we'll ask her and Pilar, who serves as her VP, to take the lead on that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, the other thing is to the extent that we do have, and I know Sylvia and Michael have this program going at BTW, but to the extent that we've got folks who are were laid off, their financial situation has changed, they can still go and enroll in different health insurance programs so that they are covered. In the interest of full disclosure, I serve on the board, Sendero Health Plans, which is HMO. And I'm not pushing them directly, but just saying that now's that there's opportunity now to go enroll in one of these programs. Some, such as Sendero, to the extent that you do have issues, they are waiving all copays associated with the virus and any sort of testing that you have to do with the virus, they're waiving. So, and I do know they are calling their clients specifically to check up on clients who they think may be high risk. So I think that's, I know some of the Sendero clients are HACA members, because I know we did sign up at the HACA properties. So I think that, so just for the board members, I think there's also, want to let you know, I think there's a second layer of folks calling, not all, but some of our residents checking on their health and well-being. Again, I think, Mike, to the extent that people have lost their jobs, now they can go and enroll in a in some affordable health insurance plans. So I think to the extent we can share that without pushing a particular HMO or PPO, but we ought to let people know that they're, all is not lost if they lost their job and they lost their insurance, because now is the time when you need insurance more so than ever.
We agree. I'll ask Pilar if you would take the lead on that. And in the interest of full disclosure for Pilar, she also serves on the board of Community Care. And so while not an insurance provider, but a healthcare provider here in the community. We can certainly make sure that, that folks continue to be aware of health resources as well as, insurance options that might be available to them. So we'll do that through Pilar's team and obviously be sensitive to not pushing any one product or set of products, but you know, making sure that people know how to access products and have choice. Mr. Chairman, I would also say just one other thing that we're working on. The HR team is working with every staff member. They're in the process of beginning a survey of all staff just to check in, see how their experience from working from home has gone, what telecommuting has like been for them. You know, the challenges of telecommuting, equipment needs, have they been in touch with their managers and supervisors? Do they have clear guidance on what they need to do in order to effectively perform their job? Just because the work is being done differently doesn't mean that the expectations aren't still high. And so, we've got to hit our marks. We've got to hit, our contractual obligations and perform for the community. And so, there's a survey that HR is going to be doing over the next several weeks of all staff to determine how this time period has been for them, for those both telecommuting and for those who have been at the properties, who have been working at the properties but are oftentimes working in a more isolated environment for their own protection. So we'll know more about what the staff says over the next month, and we'll. Mr. Chairman, I would respectfully suggest that we move on to item number three.
Yeah, let me just make one comment. I think that's a good idea to have Gloria do the survey because I think we ought to see what lessons we can learn, what are the things that we could do better, what are the processes that, you know, if this plays out longer, how we fine-tune it to make sure we're operating as efficiently as possible. And then more importantly, there's a lot of talk about trying to restart the economy before there's proper testing. And so to the extent that you may have, you know, the governor or the president decide they want to reopen the economy and your employees feel like, I'm not sure I really want to be next to somebody. I think understanding sort of the challenges we face and how long you can operate remotely, I think is a good idea because I think that's an issue that's about to come to it here right now where we may see this clash between federal rights and state rights as well as local government rights in terms of forcing people to go back to work before the health experts say that things are in a position where people can safely return to work. So with that, since this is not an item that we need to take action on, I don't know that we need to have any public comment on it. I'll defer to Wilson. Wilson, do we need to ask if there's anybody who wants to comment on it since we're not taking a vote, but this was just merely an update?
No, commissioners, this is a discussion.
Okay, so we'll go to item number three, which is a update on RAD, and I think that would be Ms. Ann Gass.
Good afternoon, commissioners, staff, and guests. My name is Ann Gass. I'm the Director of Strategic Housing Initiatives for the Housing Authority. We have two primary projects still underway in the RAD program, Goodrich Place and Chalmers Courts. I'll first touch on Goodrich. Goodrich is going through the final inspections and finishing touches as we speak. We hope to have the final inspections completed in the next 2 weeks and begin move-ins very soon after. We're really excited to be able to get our residents back home to Goodrich. As you've heard throughout this call, keeping in touch with our residents throughout this difficult time is of the utmost importance. And our resident protection team of Tiffany Middleton and our consultant on this project, OPC, remain in very regular contact with those returning residents, and they are really excited to get back home. In addition to those residents that are returning to Goodrich, we have many additional units to lease. Of the 120 total units at Goodrich, we have applications on 82% of the units. We feel really good about this progress and are just really looking forward to getting folks moved in. We are working with a management company to ensure that we're able to occupy these units with the appropriate precautions and social distancing, figuring out how to sign leases and have folks inspect units. So we're working through that to ensure everyone's safety. Moving on to Chalmers Courts, construction at Chalmers East is well underway. If you happen to have driven by the property lately, you would have seen that the foundations have been poured and the elevator shafts constructed on two of the three buildings, and the foundation for the third building is being poured as we speak. We hope to have that completed by Saturday if the weather holds out. We've also gone vertical. We officially started framing building number one, which is the building at the corner of 3rd and Chalmers. The first floor is done, and as we're speaking right now, they should be building a second floor. Again, with Chalmers, we're also working hard to stay in touch with the residents. We had a call yesterday with CVR, who's our relocation consultant for this project, where we want to begin doing virtual meetings since we can't get everybody together in person, which has been so key to our communication strategy. We're working to figure out ways to communicate with them virtually. So we're starting to talk strategies on that, and we hope to begin virtual meetings next month. We got some great news on the 9% tax credit application for Chalmers West. You may remember that we submitted that at the end of February. TDHCA's most recent update to the application log shows we're in a very good position to get an award. You may remember that when we submitted the application, there were a couple of projects ahead of us, but those projects have fallen out of competition, so that puts us right in line to get the money. We'll get final word at the TDHCA board meeting at the end of July and hope to close on this, our final RAD conversion, by the end of November of this year. You may also remember that we have 22 scattered site homes that we are not going through a RAD conversion on. And unless anybody has any questions for me, I'll hand it off to Ron Kowal, who's gonna talk a little bit more about the action we're gonna be taking. We're asking for you today on those scattered site homes.
And this is Edwina. Who is the management company for Goodrich?
Atlantic Pacific's management company is managing Goodrich.
Okay, thank you.
And we've had a good experience with them. They manage Think East, which is another project that we're partners with them on in East Austin.
And we're comfortable with the processes they've put in place for showing units, and I put that in quotations, and doing move-ins and doing what needs to be done to get those units filled.
We are. We've been working. We've been working and have a lot of experience with. I mean, we know that APC is working on those issues nationwide through their business, and all apartment management companies are struggling with the same thing. We're seeing it on Ron's side of the house through Austin Affordable Housing Corporation as we look to still rent units through AHC and through the properties that we're in partnership with, and where AMP is the management company, or in properties where, you know, NRP or AMP or APC or, you know, LDG or Ryan are in the lead, you know, with different management companies. So we, you know, there are some pretty established ways now of moving people into units that are happening where we can do it safely. This will be tricky because it's 120, you know, units, and it's, so the scale of this is large, and, you know, we're really pleased that they have so many units, you know, really in the pre-lease process. I mean, and it would say 87 units are in pre-lease or something like that out of the 120.
82%,
you know, so
98 out of 120.
Oh, 82%, even more. So there's, you know, there's clearly incredible demand. How APC sets up to be able to move those people in will be something that we'll be, you know, counting on them to do and do well. But priority is going to be given to our residents that are moving back. But we'll be
monitoring it closely. I'm sorry, Mike. How many of our residents are moving back?
12 families.
At last count, it was 12.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Ron, do you want to talk about the, as we move to item four, this is the presentation, discussion, and possible action regarding resolution 2645, authorizing the disposition of the 22 public housing scattered site units?
Hey, Mike, yes. Hold on for a second. Before we do that, I'd like to go back, and you don't have to go in detail, but if we have a virtual meeting here next month, in the report that we get, you had on item number three, can you have something regarding the kids who are in school and what's happening with them? And I just had somebody ping me that sent me a poll that said one out of every four kids in the nation who, since school has been closed, has not gotten online and doing online learning. And I know in most of our properties, and I'm not sure how many of them actually have Wi-Fi, but I would be interested in knowing what's going on, because again, I know there's attention being paid to them. I know ISD did something. I saw the deal that Ron had on Twitter and everything. But in our next report, can you make sure there's something about what's going on with them, because they make up almost the largest part of our client population. I think the kids under 18 are almost half of the population that we have. So I want to make sure they don't get lost in the cracks.
We will try to. Of course, we will turn to Boys and Girls Clubs and to the school district and to CIS and to Creative Action to find out what the programming looks like, and many of them are connecting through those programs, and of course AISD being the most significant of those players. I need to find out what the limits are on the data that we can get, but we'll get something there for you next month. Absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
So Ron, item number four is resolution 2645 on the disposition of the houses.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Commissioner, staff, guests. Ron Kowal, Vice President of Asset Management and Housing Development. And I'm presenting, as Mr. Gerber just stated, item number 2645, which is the authorization you'll give us to dispose of our single family housing assets, 20 of them of the 22, to an affiliate, Austin Housing Finance Corporation of the City of Austin, here coming up very shortly. Just a very quick background. In November of 2018 at the board meeting, the board did authorize our submission or application for the disposition to HUD's Office of the Special Application Center, or we refer to as the SAC office. And on October of 2019, we were granted, after some going in back and forth, and Sylvia did a fantastic job in taking the lead on this, we did get our application approved by the SAC office, as I stated, in October of 2019. So now that we've got that ready to go, we were fortunate enough to engage with the city's affiliate and then also, can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Yep, sure can.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to say that we've been engaging with the city's Austin Housing Finance Corporation to purchase these 20 homes in a as-is condition. They have been able to tour a number of them that Sylvia had set up with their offices, and her and I actually walked a number of them as well, and I think they've driven by all 20, probably toured 5 or 6 or 7. They're very happy with the condition of those units. The sales price is $4,539,000, and that is expected to close on May 27th. The city plans to put these homes into their community land trust program, which will at least we feel good about that in the efforts that it will be in perpetuity and remain affordable for the long term through their program. So. We're very excited about the ability to do that with them. And like I said, this is 20 of the 22. We're working on the other two homes. We're working on selling one to a resident, which should happen shortly. And then we're also maintaining one. Austin Affordable Housing Corporation will be buying one from HACA, so we can keep a resident in there who's got a very, very extensive retrofitted for their disabilities already in, and it would be very difficult for them to move and set that up again. So we're going to go ahead and take that house under our control, and we'll allow that tenant to remain under its lease. So that was a win-win too. So with that being said, I'm hoping that you all will, I'll be happy to answer questions, and Sylvia can also answer questions on this as well.
All right. Does anybody have any questions of Mr. Kowal or Ms. Blanco?
Ron, Edwina, on the one house that Austin Affordable is keeping, will the management of that go under AMP, or will you all just look at doing that in-house?
The management will go under AMP, who already manages, 18 or 19 of our other single-family homes. And obviously we'll keep close contact with that, but that's the easiest way for us to handle that one.
Okay. Thank you.
So, commissioners,
Ron,
after go ahead,
Ron. Just for clarification, just if anybody's listening, and I'm not sure if they are, but can you clarify just a little bit when you say the other 18?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Yes. So, Austin Affordable Housing Corporation, years and years ago, were able to purchase. From Austin Youth Works, I think is the corporation that used to do that. And we purchased 18 of their single family homes, and we took that under our portfolio. And the majority of those, if not all, for the most part, are rented out to our Housing Choice Voucher holders. And so we've had those in our portfolio for at least, at least 20 years, I believe. And they're 100% occupied, doing very well, and very well kept and very well run, and provides a very good, affordable homes for many people.
To clarify, the name is American Youth Works.
American Youth Works, sorry.
But that was 18 units, and so now we're at 22, selling 20.
Let me clarify. We're talking.
No. That's why I wanted to have that clarification. So think about it. We've got two different categories of single-family homes. So the 18 that we're selling, the 20 that we're selling, those were part of an old public housing portfolio. Is that correct? And the 18 that we bought from American Youth Works is a different category. It's still single-family homes, but they are in a different tranche, bought at a different period of time.
Okay.
Correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. That's the reason why I wanted to make sure that if anybody was listening, because when we talked about this some time ago, I was a little confused. I remember buying the houses from American Youth Works, but I didn't realize at the time that we also owned some single family homes that were part of the public housing portfolio. Yep. I saw them on paperwork, but didn't understand kind of what they were. But I wanted to make sure we as a board had clarity that we will still have some single family dwellings, although we're about to sell 20. So, in essence, we really had 50 single family homes.
Well,
any other questions from me?
This is Chuck. That raises a question. Why aren't we selling all of them?
Go ahead.
Well, there's a couple reasons that's. I mean, Mike, we want to answer that, or would you like me to?
No, go ahead, Ron.
Well, I was just going to say, I think staff has had extensive meetings on this, and there's a couple reasons that we think it's a good choice. Number one, the houses are going to require some good love and TLC. As Jimmy's done just a fantastic job of keeping these houses up as best he can. There are some issues that will come up that will need to be addressed in the near future from a cost and a capital expense side. And the city's aware of that and embrace that. That was one of the reasons that the disposition to the city was a better plan. But more importantly, the management and the bandwidth to manage a community land trust portfolio, when we only have two right now, was pretty difficult. It would have, they have a bigger pot of residents and affordability that they can apply to. And I think our thought process was, at least we know this portfolio is going into an affordable platform under the city's control, which is their CLT program, which is exactly like ours. So it just seemed to be more, it seemed to make much more sense for us to do, because the management and the undertaking of a CLT program is very difficult, and we just didn't have, we don't have the bandwidth to service those in terms of taxes and insurance and manage monthly payments as they come in, and financing is very difficult. So, most banks are not very open to financing a community land trust program, because they don't have the house stays in the land stays in the ownership of the housing authority, so all they're getting is the asset or the house. So it's much more difficult to find mortgage loans, and the city has a program that they fit to mirror that, to make it much easier for a resident to purchase. So there's a lot of reasons.
But Ron, let me interrupt you there. I understand why we're selling the 18 we're selling, but I thought Carl just said, well, we've got another 18 or so that we're not selling, and I wanted to know why we aren't selling all
right.
of them.
So I think it's important to clarify the houses. So the houses that we're selling are the ones that have been historically in our public housing program, and they've been hamstrung by a wide variety of HUD rules and been funded by HUD or underfunded by HUD. And so, those are properties that are different than the ones that we have in our continuing community land trust that Ron administers, where those houses are, we can be successful on those houses. They have a different and far less set of rules, and we're not hamstrung by HUD and all of its requirements. the city, by purchasing these homes, are taking over all of those additional requirements, and we're just largely getting the benefits.
I'm not, Mike, questioning the selling of them.
Yeah.
My question, and you just answered it, the others are better for us. We don't have as much problem running those or taking care of them. So we'll keep those. Is that right?
Exactly, exactly. And as we find opportunities to buy more homes that we can, you know, given increasing land costs, I mean, we may find some great opportunities to buy more homes and put them into an expanding home ownership program through the CLT. We pick up one here and there.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Well, this is Edwina. I have a follow-up question, though. So on the 20 that we're disposing of, or 22 if you count how we're doing disposing of the other two, part of what I understood was even though we've got a third-party management company, I know part of the reason for the disposition was the difficulties of managing scattered site housing. Yet you're telling me on the other side, we're keeping the ones that we acquired through LandWorks. Who are they? Richard Halpin's group.
American Youth Works.
And because they're in our land trust, and then we're considering purchasing more. So it doesn't seem to, the explanation doesn't seem to be consistent with what we're doing.
Let me clarify. The 18 homes that the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation owns are not in the community land trust. Those are just single family homes.
They're the public housing units that we have. But the others are.
No, that's
the difference. So the 22 that we're getting ready to dispose of are public housing.
Right.
So think about it. They are public housing under the public housing rules and regulation. The 18 we bought from American Youth Works are not public housing. We didn't buy them under the guy. So there's a different set of rules and regulations that apply. That's what I gather from Mike, is having to sort of navigate dealing with these single family homes under the public housing rules is a lot more difficult or burdensome than it is the homes we just bought outright that we actually own, that we don't have to have the same, we don't have sort of the same sort of requirements.
Okay, so it's basically the HUD requirements on the 22 that, and now we've gotten approval from HUD to dispose of them, but that's basically the reason or the reasons that we want to dispose of those, and the reason we would be acquiring more would be because they go under the land trust, you've bought them on the private market, we put our own restrictions on them. Is that basically the bottom line?
Correct.
If we were going to do that, we would have our own controls and our own restrictive covenants that pertain to those. Unlike what HUD or public housing would have make us have. That's correct.
Okay, I'm good. Fine, thank you.
Now, I've got another question now. Mike, I think you answered this when we talked yesterday. There's a possibility we could put these public housing units, single-family units, through RAD. Is that correct?
We're going to take the proceeds from them, the $4.5 million we expect to receive, and we will be using that for gap that we have at Chalmers West potentially, and more likely for Rosewood Courts.
But if we wanted to, and I think y'all explained that you don't want to, we could treat these like the other public housing units that we have, or that they're going to become ours through the RAD program. Could we not do the same thing with these 18 or 22 houses?
Well, so we've done some vouchering at Chalmers, and Ron and Sylvia, do you want to maybe just, so we're not losing any housing through the RAD process.
I understand that. No, I understand. But we could do the same thing with these houses if they're considered public housing. Why aren't we putting them through the RAD program and treating them like BTW or or any of the other units that are public housing that we're putting through the RAD program.
I think the big reason, and Ron, you may want to chime in, and Sylvia, the economics of it, the economics of it wouldn't work. We would do we put lipstick on the pig, but we wouldn't do anything significant to the property. It just wouldn't make sense to do it. Sylvia, do you want to touch on it?
Sure. So really, you're looking at sort of the economies of scales. When you got a multifamily development, it's more cost effective to do the modernization as opposed to if you had just a single family, you had several single family properties that you had to do one by one. Whereas with a multifamily property, because of the scale, you can grow more efficiencies and it's less expensive to do the remod as opposed to taking 10 separate single family houses that are scattered across the city and trying to do them. Is that correct?
Generally as a principle, yep. And Sylvia, do you want to touch on that?
Yes. To the chairman's point, yes, it's because of these houses literally scattered throughout the city. We still have management and maintenance challenges to ensure that they are maintained and in good shape, collecting rent. So even if we were to convert them under the RAD program, we would still have those ongoing challenges. And with the RAD program, we have a finite budget that is available to maintain and manage the properties. So we're having to incur additional expense under the public housing program and then theoretically, under the RAD program, if we were to continue to keep that portfolio under the RAD program. So the other thing that is a challenge is all of the residents who reside in those 22 scattered sites do not have the benefit of the after-school programs and the resident self-sufficiency programs that the rest of our residents do have access to because of being on a multifamily site. So they have less access to meaningful programs and services that can really help make an impact on self-sufficiency. So the inefficiency of maintaining and managing those sites does not go away under the RAD program. They're just too expensive.
How much difference would there be if we put them under the RAD program and maintaining them from the other houses that we have in the land trust? I tell you, what I'm getting at is this a good investment that we're getting rid of because it's too much trouble?
We have gone through many, many discussions and different iterations of scenarios. And ultimately, through those discussions, the best scenario for us economically and in serving residents was to go ahead and dispose of the scattered site units. As you may recall, the rents within the RAD program are extremely low, and they really would not allow us to fully benefit from the market value of those houses. So we would essentially be stuck in a very low price point of RAD rents if they were to be converted under that program.
Yeah, but we're not in the business of worrying about making money. And if you were talking about self-sufficiency, it looks to me like what a great way to help people get to self-sufficiency by giving them their own homes or letting them live in their own homes.
I know y'all said you've
talked about it at length and gone all over the scenarios. This is the first time I've heard anything about it. And, I just think those questions need to be asked.
So Chuck, the questions you're asking are great questions. When I first got on the board and I learned about, the way I learned about the houses is because when I first got on the board, I wanted, when we kind of cleaned up everything, when Hargrove and I would kind of meet one-on-one just to talk about different things, I was pushing him about why don't we go out and buy single family homes. And it took him a little while, but he finally explained to me and got it across to my thick head that that was not the best use of the funds that we got. And in order to do that, we would need to find a different source of revenue because HUD is not going to give us money to go buy single family homes to put people in. We can help people find a way to get into it, but HUD was not going to go finance that. And that, you know, they had done that with these 22 homes, but they were not in the business of helping us get to single family homes. And I'm telling you, it took me, Chuck, a couple of years to really sort of come to the real, to stop fighting that fight. Because where you go is where I went back in 1999.
I came on the board about the time you changed your mind, and I remember us buying the houses from Youth Works, and we went through all these same type of scenarios. And I guess what I'm asking is if we can get these houses, why they would be and change and get out from under all the HUD issues, why they would be any different from the ones we have in the land bank. And by putting them through RAD, it seems to me we'd do that.
When you put them through RAD, they're still going to be rental units. They're not going to be home ownership units. And just to clarify, the disposition of the 22 scattered sites has been in our PHA annual plan multiple years now, and this was brought to the board in 2018 for approval to submit this disposition application to HUD.
Well, I've slept since 2018, so I have not really gotten into details about this. I'm not going to belabor the point anymore. It just seems to me like maybe there are other policy reasons unrelated to expense, unrelated to administrative difficulties that I don't necessarily agree with staff on. So thanks for the explanation, and I'll see how I want to vote when it comes time to vote.
Yeah. So I think the deal is if the opportunity presented itself with another, like what American Youth Works brought to us, if another opportunity presented itself, we would look hard, very hard at taking that opportunity, because that would be a little different in terms of buying single family homes that didn't have the HUD restrictions that we could find a way to provide home ownership opportunities in, as opposed to putting them into a RAD program. Because if we were to, if somebody were to bequeath us, let's say 10 homes, we would not want them to go into RAD and be under that set of regulations. We would want to keep them separate. And, you know, what we're doing with the homes we got now is put them in the land trust. But even you, there's nothing that would require us to do that. We could actually take them and to use them for single family homes that we could sell to residents who could qualify for it so they can have their own. So in terms of where you want to go, Chuck, we could actually get there if there was an opportunity, but I just want us to be clear, if that opportunity comes, we wouldn't be taking them back into RAD because we would be going into a set of regulations that we don't want to be in. In essence, we'd like to have the luxury to do whatever we want to, whatever though, with the new homes that we acquired in order to facilitate home ownership.
But I think we also have to be realistic about whether or not our residents could even get there and could qualify on their own. I mean, we've got one resident who we're working with to try to, you know, one of the remaining two houses, you know, one's for a person with severe disabilities, the other is for, that we're trying to get into this young lady's hands. and we've made so many concessions, the normal market, and we're offering basically a third off the house. You know, no business can operate that way. So we're doing a one-time thing because we think it's the right thing to do. But we could never do something like that. You know, again, this person's just lucked out because of the timing and the need to move this portfolio along. But this is a portfolio that we think gets preserved well by folks who will administer it well, and it's preserved for affordable purposes. This has not been a portfolio that's made us any additional resources or has made us, you know, frankly, any friends. I mean, some of these homes have been hard to maintain. They're tough to get folks to qualify and to realize that kind of shared equity thing in a CLT if we ever were to go there. We never saw the potential of that, and that's why we were so grateful that the city did. We're actually kind of stunned that the city did, but they've got a more sophisticated CLT and they've got the staff able to manage it. We don't feel that it plays to our core strengths. Absolutely, if there was a home ownership program where we had 10 homes and we could be successful at getting, you know, public housing residents into their new homes and could figure that out, absolutely we'd want to make that work. But that's a different type of thing that I think we need to just be realistic about. This portfolio is something that has been a challenged portfolio, you know, that of 22 public scattered site units. We came to the board in November of 2018 because of concerns about that portfolio and the fact that we didn't think, because of the low rents and because of what we were hearing from the residents in those units, that we could be successful in going and converting it to RAD. And that's why we made the decision to, you know, as we look to additional densification of our properties at Chalmers Courts and Goodrich and other places, we felt like this was the right course of action for this part of the portfolio.
Right. And I'll just say this last thing. I mean, I think we have been trying to help folks get into single family. We have a, you know, home ownership program where we help people with the first $10,000. And that's a good start, but that doesn't get people to where they need to be, because, again, the average home in Austin, from the last numbers I saw, is somewhere around $318,000. So 20% down puts you somewhere about $62,000-$64,000 of a down payment. And so having somebody come out of public housing to qualify for a house like that is pretty tough. But having said that, I will ask, is there anyone on the phone from the general public who would like to have comments at this time before we bring this item for a vote? Hearing that nobody from the general public has any comments on this item, so I will entertain a motion to approve resolution number 2645, authorizing the disposition of 22 public housing scattered site units.
I so moved.
I think I heard Commissioner Apostolo make a motion, and I think I heard Commissioner Carrington second.
Yes.
Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I just interject? Because I think it's important also to just have perspective. Yes, we've talked about RAD. You know, I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is that, you know, we knew walking into RAD, we really looked at RAD holistically. The dollars that we're going to get, the $4.5 million that we're going to receive, is going to make a significant difference again for those gaps that we have. And it's more than we, you know, in part of the trade-offs, we need that gap financing, and we determined that as we started RAD, frankly, more than we need these houses. The trade-off is then, you know, for the loss of these, you know, 20 single family homes, you know, we're going to see probably 45 to 50 new apartment units coming up because of this, with a far better, more efficient, you know, quality of more modern, more efficient quality of life for residents with far more amenities than we would have had before. So, I mean, we've had some of these trade-off discussions, and I just want to remind folks of that. But I hear what the board's saying about homeownership, and it's important to us when it's on Ron's side of the house. It's just been very, very tough in the public housing side of it, and we have had to make some difficult trade-offs. And so I want to acknowledge that, but I want you to know that, that a lot of good is still going to come from this choice. And the residents have been apprised of it as we've kind of walked through this. And the two that couldn't make it across the finish line, the disabled person and the resident who, you know, wants to purchase their home, you know, we're very committed to them organizationally and making them successful and whole.
So, Mike, you raise you bring to mind something, the question that we never have asked and should have been asked at the very beginning. Of these 22, we know two families are going to remain in there. What's going to happen with the other 20 families that are in those homes? Is the city going to displace them? The city going to work
no.
with them? What happens?
No, they remain. No, we are working with them. We are working with every one of those residents, and we're giving them the choices that every resident had when you've signed these contracts with Overland Pacific and with CVR. You know, our team is working. Tiffany Middleton and others have been working with these residents to give them choices about where they may wish to live in all parts of the city. They have opportunities to use vouchers. No one is being displaced. Is that correct, Sylvia?
That is correct. And if I can expand on that, out of the 20 households, there are only two that remain. So 18 out of those 20 have already relocated. They had the opportunity to choose between a Section 8 voucher or one of HACA's properties. And every single household, with the exception of one, chose a Section 8 voucher. The one outlier chose to remain at a HACA property and has already relocated to one of our properties. And every single family was provided assistance with a relocation search, housing search, and also moving expenses. So all of them have been taken care of very well by Tiffany Middleton and CVR. And again, we're down to two units that are going to need to relocate. All of the other ones are vacated.
So for the record, Mike, you and Sylvia, y'all didn't go out with any arm twisting or any sort of heavy handedness or bait and switch to get anybody out of those units and to get them into get them to select another option. Is that correct? It's a yes or no. Okay. In essence, the whole point is that the option to move is a better option than what it was to stay, right?
Yes.
In terms, because that's kind of where we were going to. One of the reasons is those properties were difficult to maintain, and so if you've got an option to stay where you are to move, you're moving to a better location. And what I'm saying is, you didn't go out there and coerce them; they chose that on their own because it was they saw a better quality of life, right?
Carl, you've known this group of people for 20 years. Have you ever thought that anyone?
I'm just Mike.
Would, yeah,
I'm
correct.
Just,
I would know. No one has moved. Has forced, cajoled, harassed, haggled, or otherwise compelled somebody to move. Correct.
Boy, you guys better be glad this isn't. You better be glad this isn't the trial, because I'd have been jumping from cross examining Mike for the next hour and a half.
I know,
we would recommend moving the motion.
He's not a very good witness, that's why I had to lead him.
Yeah.
So with that, all in favor, just for the purposes of the record, I'll ask for a roll call vote.
Commissioner Bailey.
No.
Commissioner Duncan Hall.
Yes.
Commissioner Carrington.
Yes.
Commissioner Apostolo.
Here you are.
Commissioner Apostolo. Commissioner Apostolo.
Yes. So move. Yes.
Chairman Ritchie.
Yes.
Passes by a vote of 4-1.
All right. Let the record reflect that Commissioner Bailey and I were not texting each other email in each other. We just know each other well enough that I knew he wanted a roll call vote so he could express his opinion on the record. With that, we will go on to item number 5, which is a presentation, discussion, and possible action on resolution number 2646, approving the submission of the Section 8 Management Assessment Program, otherwise known as CMAP, to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Affairs, Urban Development. Ms. Garcia.
Yes. Good afternoon, commissioners, staff, and guests. This is Lisa Garcia, the Vice President of Assisted Housing. And I'm here today to ask for the board's approval of resolution number 2646. This is approving of the submittal of the Section 8 assessment program certification to the Department of Housing and Urban Development for the period from April 1, 2019 through March 31st, 2020. And I'm pleased to report that after completing all the necessary quality control sample audits, an analysis that the Housing Authority of the City of Boston has scored 104% this year. Detailed in your board packet is the specific indicators, the 14 indicators, and the results of the review of all the indicators. And at this point, I'd like to open up to any questions that you might have.
Does anyone have any questions of Ms. Garcia from the board?
Well, no question, but a comment. This is Edwina. Congratulations, Lisa and staff. I know that this is a higher score this year than it was last year. And what do we attribute that higher score to, the 104%?
Yes, well, thank you. I appreciate your comments. And with regards to the deconcentration bonus point analysis, I can just sort of go over how we were able to get that those additional points this year. Each year we take a look at the deconcentration bonus analysis, which basically looks at families with children that are assisted under the Housing Choice Voucher Program, where they're living and where they're moving to. And if they're living in low poverty census tracts or moving to low poverty census tracts. And we use the data from the 2016 American Community Survey. And for the one thing that we look at is where the families with children living at the end of the fiscal year. So this year they were 36.7% were living in low poverty census tracts. It is 2% lower than it was last year. However, we also look at the number of families that are moving into, you know, low poverty census tracts. And this year, 39.3% of families with children that moved into low poverty census tracts. And this is under this particular indicator. It states that if the people that moved into low poverty census tracts is 2% percentage points higher than the total number living in those areas at the end of the fiscal year, then you're eligible for the point. So 39.3% of the families that moved into low poverty census tracts, and 36.7% lived in those areas, which is more than 2 percentage points higher. Therefore, we receive the points under this indicator. So what is it attributed to? I think, you know, I would say that, you know, with Austin affordable housing properties, you know, we've been able to get a lot more properties in low poverty census tracts. We have a fair number of families moving into those, into the Austin affordable housing properties that we've made those available. I think we're up to about 700 families right now that are living in Austin affordable housing properties throughout the voucher program.
And those are 700 or so out of what, Ron, 5,000 units or so?
About 5,300 units.
Okay.
Ours is 7,000 units. Yes, she's got 5,300 vouchers total of those. Is that correct, Lisa?
Yeah.
Yeah, the portfolio is about 7,500.
And we have like 700 vouchers 500 vouchers or 700 vouchers spread throughout that AA Austin Affordable portfolio?
700.
700. Okay. All righty. Thank you.
Any other questions from any board members? At this time, the chair will ask if there's anyone from the general public who would like to comment or speak on this issue at this time. Hearing none, the chair will entertain a motion to approve resolution number 2646, which is the submission of the CMAP certification to HUD.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Commissioner. It's motion by Commissioner Apostolo, seconded by Commissioner Duncan Hall. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And we'll go to item number six, which is presentation, discussion, and possible action on resolution number 2647, which is to take the following action regarding Moonlight Gardens in Austin, Texas, to acquire the site of the development, lease the development site to the owner of the development, and such other actions as necessary or convenient to carry out this resolution. Mr. Kowal.
So, Mr. Chairman, and Ron, let me ask, do we need to do this first through Austin Affordable Housing Corporation?
Yeah, let's go to Austin.
Yeah, I think it would be better because AHC is actually making the decision to enter into the deal, and HOP is just basically allowing us to ground lease the land like we some other do. So I think it probably really doesn't matter, but if I would defer to Bill, but I think it's probably better to go AHC first. Isn't that correct, Bill?
That's the way we've done it in the past. So why don't we put this, why don't we table this item for the time being and turn to the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. Okay. And let's just dispose of the consent agenda real quickly, which is basically the approval of the board minutes from the March 26, 2020 meeting. Is there any member of the general public that would like to speak on this item? Hearing none, the chair will entertain a motion to approve the minutes from the March 26, 2020 meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation.
I move approval.
Motion made by Commissioner Duncan Hall, seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And now we go to item number two, which is the presentation, discussion, and possible action on resolution number 157 by the Board of Directors of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation to authorize the corporation to execute any and all documents, take any other action that's desirable to facilitate the development of Moonlight Gardens, which consists of market and affordable housing units and associated amenities built on the land to be ground leased from the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. And at this time, is it Ms. Wertner or Mr. Kowal?
Let Suzanne go ahead and walk us through the presentation that she provided for you, and she's done a lot of work on this project, so I'll let her start. We'll be happy to answer questions following.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Good afternoon, Commissioner, staff, and guests. Suzanne Shorten with Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. Today we are speaking about Moonlight Gardens. This is a partnership with LDG Multifamily. The affordable structure is 50% of the units will be serving tenants at 80% of the area median family income and below. The other 50% will serve tenants from 80% to 120% area median family income. This is in line with the City of Austin's affordable housing blueprint plan. We will be serving any tenants with housing choice vouchers. We have made the decision that we will not do business with any partners that do not want us to serve housing choice vouchers. This is a 10-acre tract of land. We have 264 units. The breakdown is really good. 48 one-bedroom, 122 bedroom, 96 three-bedroom. This project will cost around $51 million to construct, with $4 million of that being the cost of land. We are taking out a HUD loan through Mason Joseph at an interest rate of 3.45%. And then LDG and Austin Affordable will put in 50% each of the equity, the remaining equity. This equates to a cash investment for Austin Affordable of around $3.822 million. We are asking that we be able to contribute $1 million at closing, and then the additional $2.822 over the 24-month period. We are able to put that either in installments, or we can wait until the end of the 24 months. This is part of the Goodnight Ranch Master Plan. It's over 700 acres. Part of the plan is an education village. They have already built Blazer Elementary, and it has received the highest rating from the TEA, a 6-star rating. They have already closed on the land for Blazer Middle School and are in the planning stages and should be starting construction really soon. And then after that is complete, they will build a high school. All of these schools will be connected by sidewalks, so it's actually within walking distance of each one, which is wonderful for families. This master plan is, the idea behind it is to provide a variety of products for all ages of life and all incomes. It includes single-family homes, townhomes, duplex units, a senior community, which is mixed income, and also our other partnership with LDG, Goodnight Commons, which is a tax credit property, 304 units, and it is serving tenants with 60% area median income and below. The master plan also includes 30 acres of walking trails, a community pool, so it's really definitely a neighborhood and family trending community. A little bit more about Goodnight Commons. It is in lease-up right now. It's 74% occupied, 78% leased, so people will be moving in. Right now we have 14 vouchers out there. The reason that that's a little bit lower is because we were in shortfall status, so we didn't have any new vouchers to offer until the beginning of this year. So now we're getting more voucher holders calling to see if they can occupy. With the coronavirus, we have gone to virtual tours, and this has really been great for leasing. We are still receiving about 125 to 150 phone calls per week with people interested in leasing. This location, not only is it in the master plan, but if you go a mile and a half to the west and cross I-35, you will be at South Park Meadows Shopping Center. So there's really a demand for affordable housing in this area. Most of the projects that are already built are market rate. So our projects with the 60% and below tax credit property, and then our step up property, Moonlight Gardens, would provide, you know, a great mix. And we can serve the lower income, and then those that are at 61% income that don't qualify for Goodnight Commons can go over to Moonlight and still rent. I
think that's about it. I'm definitely available to answer questions if anybody has any.
Let me just say this real quickly, that I kind of rushed to this item since I was on the HACA agenda, but the Austin Affordable Housing agenda should be handled by Chairwoman Carrington. She's chair of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation, so I apologize for crossing the line. So, Commissioner Carrington, you're in charge.
Thank you, Mr. HACA Chair. I appreciate that. You were doing such a good job, I was just going to let you go right on. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Schwertner on Moonlight Gardens?
Madam Chairwoman, this is Chuck. I've got a couple of really more of a just a comment, and this is something that I talked with Mike and Ron about yesterday. I'm going to vote for this. I think it's a good program, a good project. Anything that's called Moonlight reminds me of Moonlight Graham from Field of Dreams, and I guess that's about as good as the baseball level gets right now. But in light of the COVID crisis and the potential for, if not a depression, at least a very, very deep recession, and some of these units are going to be market value units, it's just something that it seems to me like we ought to discuss. And you've heard it's like Cassandra in the Trojan War. I feel like I'm preaching doom and gloom, and I am, I guess, because that's all you hear. But this is a good project. Just happened to come along at a difficult time. At some point in time, because we have gotten so heavily involved in the development business, I think we need to take a step back and see how far we want to keep going until we know what the economy is going to do. Now, Mike and Ron have a very good explanation and a good way of pointing out that, you know, if we go down, everybody else is going to go down too. But I don't know. Is anybody else worried about it besides me?
I'm not, because I think this is a good option in terms of it provides a good sort of jumping off point for folks who are in the commons who may make more money. I'm looking at all this information just like everybody else is, and I'm trying to remain optimistic. But I do think that there are going to be folks who, when this is all said and done, that there'll still be people who need housing. In fact, actually, I think there'll be more people needing affordable housing more so than they do all those downtown luxury condos that have been built. So I think our market, and I could be wrong, and I'd welcome Edwina chiming in, but I think in a down economy, affordable developments and leases programs, Section 8, they become a lot more important and a lot more significant in their programs that people will look at just because of where they are financially. So I think, I think you raise a good point about whether we should be thinking about whether we should be doing more deals. I think the circumstances will dictate which way we go, but I think we're going into an economy for at least a temporary period of time where our properties, people being to move into our properties, are going to be a lot more attractive to folks because of where they're economically, where some people are going to end up when it's all said and done.
And I would echo that, Carl. I think the housing is always going to be needed. I think the key and the concern for us is, yes, residents need the housing. Can they pay the rent? And I know that this is one of the things that Ron and all have watched very closely. with rental incomes, people paying their rent in April, and looking at that through the across the Austin affordable portfolio. And Ron, I think at least in April, AMP had pretty good collections, I think.
We're at 94.2% of our income has been collected as of yesterday.
I think the real, you know, as we all want to know how long this is going to go on, where people might have had some resources or had a job so that they could pay April rent, then what about May? You know, are they going to be able to pay May rent? Are they going to be able to pay June rent? So I think that's from a is the housing needed standpoint, the answer is yes, and I agree that the more affordable, the better that's going to be for at least the populations we look to serve. And I know in talking to Ron and Suzanne and Mike about this development that this is such a unique opportunity for us. If this had been, and I don't want to speak for staff, but at least what's been shared with me is if this had been just another development in an area that we weren't already committed to, didn't already have quite an engagement there, we probably wouldn't be seeing this as a board. But because of the involvement already in Goodnight Ranch and how well Goodnight Commons is leasing up, and the fact that LDG is such a good partner of ours, that there are reasons that we're seeing this particular transaction today, where there would be a number of others that I don't believe that Ron and Suzanne would be bringing to us.
That's correct, Chair Carrington. We've gone back and forth a lot on this deal, and Suzanne and Ron have worked, you know, on this for many, many, many months, long before coronavirus hit. And when we can get you out to Goodnight, I think you'll be really impressed by what a vibrant and really neat master plan community it is. It's something that features schools, single family homes, just a wealth of opportunities. Slaughter Lane's on the south. Onion Creek Municipal Park is on the north, with the soccer fields just to the north of that, with kind of the far eastern edge of William Cannon. And it's just an area that is seeing an incredible amount of growth that I think is exactly where we want to be. That property, Goodnight, is just going gangbusters, and you know, it's already 75% full, and it's only been open for a very short period of time. It's a 300 unit property. Yeah, this is going to serve folks at a slightly different level, but we feel like it continues to meet our affordability objectives and provide really valued housing, and gives us a foothold in Southeast Austin in a way that we wouldn't be otherwise. And much like we are at that combination of Harris Ridge Seniors and Tech Ridge and Center Ridge, they're all kind of nearby. We get a lot of synergy from what we have kind of in Northeast Austin. This gives us a lot of synergy in Southeast Austin, with Asher just being a mile and a half up the road. These two properties here at Goodnight, it's exciting for us. But I will say, to Commissioner Bailey's point, we are doing an awful lot of analysis. We're not just looking at you look at the normal things, but we're looking very closely at what the market analysis shows. We're looking very closely at what the underwriting shows, and as we look to those big questions of is there enough money to build this thing, and getting this thing right, and calculating incomes and cash flows, we're being very, very careful about that. And that's why you see the pro forma that you have in the book, just assuming a 93% occupancy. Most of Ron's properties are well above 93%. If you just look at the sheet in your book, 97%, 99%, 98%, 100%, you know, we see an awful lot of opportunity to do some good, and a lot of opportunity to serve a lot of folks, and also to see a nice return to the housing authority that'll enable us to do some other things as well.
Let me respond. I'll just respond.
No, I would. I just said, please go ahead, Commissioner Bailey.
Oh, all right. I agree with everything that Mike said. I said I'm gonna vote for this, and I'm not much inclined to kick a dead horse around, but everything Mike says and Carl says and Edwina says is right. But if you ignore the potential, and I'm talking, and you know, I'm no economist. The people that are going to get hit, I think, are the people that are most benefit for affordable housing. They don't have any jobs. It doesn't make any difference whether it's public housing. They will have no jobs. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I guess I'm really talking about any future development issues that come before us, because this is what, Mike, an 18-month project, and we're starting from scratch. Not like we're going out and buying an apartment complex. We're developers in this deal, and in downturns. And I know we've got all the protections, and Ron and Suzanne have done an excellent job keeping us protected. But if for the next 6 months we go into something really bad, I don't want us to get caught with our pants down on this one. I think we just need to be, and maybe this is, Mike, maybe this is something for the staff to look at. Just look at the dynamics, because I'm sure all the universities and everybody else looking at this stuff right now, not on this deal. This is the timing on it is, in my opinion, unfortunate, but I think we would be foolish not to go ahead and take advantage of it and bet on the come. And then that's it. I just think the board needs to be aware of these things. And Edwina and Carl, y'all both in the business, so I know you know. But for us outsiders that are not developers, not in the real estate business, and have just seen through observation over the years. Unfortunately, I wasn't alive during the Depression, but it's just something I think we need to be concerned about.
I think that's very fair, Commissioner Bailey, and Commissioner Karen. If I could just say, you know, one of the things that we are struggling with is that, you know, we are anticipating that there will be a lot of new resources that may come to agencies like ours, to housing finance organizations like, you know, which, you know, Austin Affordable, you know, is, that we may wish to, and we may wish to take advantage of. And I think we'll have to walk through that very carefully with the board. With the Great Recession, you know, back 2008, 2009, there were a wealth of, you know, opportunities, you know, housing organizations were given a chance to take advantage of. And I think HACA took advantage of some, but I think we will have others in this, given the immense need we're seeing. But I agree with you. We have to be very, very protective. We don't have, you know, we have a lower appetite for risk, and we need to make sure that we have the guarantees and protections in place to protect our residents and our existing portfolio. So I hear you loud and clear, but I don't want to, and maybe Bill Walter, based on some of the things he's seeing nationally, you know, through his work, you know, maybe want to highlight some of the things that, you know, could potentially come our way. I mean, post Great Recession, it was a TDHCA never had so many tools. The Neighborhood Stabilization Program, the Tax Credit Assistance Program. I mean, we did arguably double the amount of tax credits in 1 year, than we had ever done. And organizations like AHC would be just the type of organization to take advantage of some of those things. And those deals did a lot of good in their communities. But if with your indulgence, Chair Carrington, if maybe Bill wanted to chime in, that would be great. Just give some perspective more broadly. His practice is nationally.
Bill? Chairwoman Carrington, if I could, let me just make a quick comment. And this is for Chuck and for Tara and for Mary. Mike is right. In a downturn like this, organizations like ours there'll be a lot of opportunities to be presented to us. I remember back when they had the RTC, when the economy went the bottom fell out back in the early 80s. And at the time, I worked for the city of Houston, and the housing authority in the city were able to do some very creative things just because we had so many people coming to us with all sorts of opportunities about different housing stuff. The city created a first-time home ownership program because it was able to acquire single-family properties through the RTC. So Mike is right that there will be a number of different opportunities come our way because of the governmental entity that's involved in housing, and all these developers who have done some of these exotic deals will be, and that's to use your term, Chuck, exotic. They'll be turning to us to look to find a way to either bail them out or to help partner with them on some things. And so there'll be a lot of opportunities come our way. And so I know, Suzanne and Ron and Mike will do, and well as Lisa and Sylvia will, look very carefully, I would say very judiciously, at the things that come our way. But there are going to be a lot of opportunities come our way. So Chuck, what you're seeing, what we've been doing, I think you're going to see a lot of folks approach us, and I mean approach us individually, wanting to talk to us about deals that the housing authority ought to take a look at.
Thank you, Carl. Bill Walter, was there anything that you wanted to add to Mike's question or to our comments? Bill? Okay. Is there any more discussion on item number 2, which is the resolution 157? Do we have
Chair,
any...
if you recognize me, go ahead.
Yes. Is that Bill, is that you?
No, that was Carl.
I will
be quiet and allow the public to talk.
I was just getting ready to say that. But thank you. Thank you, Mr. AHC. Never mind. Thank you, Carl. is there anyone from the public that would like to comment on our consideration of Moonlight Garden?
Chair Carrington, okay, I think Bill may be he may have been accidentally muted, and so Bill, he may be unmuted now.
Yes, hi, are you there?
Yes, we
there
are.
You are, Bill.
Hi. Well, I'll make this very brief. I think our expectation, as Mike was saying, is just as with the last downturn, national groups are gearing up to advocate for the same kind of relief programs that we saw before. And sort of like Mike mentioned, the TCAP program, the exchange program, it is our expectation that there will be additional resources targeted toward groups like the Housing Authority to allow them to have resources to continue affordable housing development.
Okay.
Chair Carrington, can I ask a quick question to Bill, though? So, Bill, How do you go and, I mean, at the core, I think, of all this, for all of us, is is now that we're in this new world, what things are you advising me, Ron, Suzanne, you know, Chair Carrington, and others? What new things should we be doing by way of due diligence? We were already doing a bunch of things to make sure these deals were safe. How do we now go the extra mile to make sure they're safe? What things are you looking at, and what are you advising your clients, and what are you seeing nationally? I understand Texas is a little different, and we're a little more sophisticated player than maybe some others. But what, you know, what's that next level of assurance that we can get, you know, on this that, you know, we maybe want to think about and that we are thinking about?
So there's two main things right at the moment. One is from the development side, folks are giving additional scrutiny to their underwriting of developments, especially where there are market rate units in them. So I think folks are scrubbing those and looking closer than maybe they were before. And then on the lending side, and this behooves developers too, we're seeing Fannie and Freddie and even FHA look at their reserve requirements and increasing those as an additional kind of contingency against any downturn. So I'm not sure if the FHA lender on this transaction has raised it yet, but I know in the FHA panels, they're giving additional scrutiny to the amount of reserves to be held, and Fannie and Freddie are requiring extra debt service reserves now as part and parcel of every loan that they close.
As it relates specifically, yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Sorry, two things. If you've already had your rate lock, your firm commitment and rate lock, the new reserve requirements don't apply. But secondly, they did look at this as a case by case, and even moving forward, the guidance I received on a call the other day was that every property that comes before Fannie, Freddie, or FHA, while they are looking to increase reserves, probably instead of the typical 6 months or 4 to 6 months, they may go to 9, but each deal is going to stand on its own. And I echo what Bill said, is that even this deal that we're talking about now, Moonlight, was scrubbed especially a little bit harder just because of the timing. We were not required to put up any additional reserves at this time, but moving forward, that may be a requirement depending on a bunch of things, and really the market study and how many market rents, how many market units there are, blah, 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 blah. So that is something that we're watching moving forward, because it does change a little bit, it does change the transaction a little bit.
Ron, are there, oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mike, and then I have a comment that I want to add.
Ron, are there, as we go forward on this deal and on other deals, can we look at, as we, you know, do our, you know, feasibility analysis, as we, you know, get, you know, things from consultants, the market consultants and the economic consultants, and, you know, the estimates that we get from the construction folks, and, you know, all throughout this, there's lots of professionals and lots of due diligence. And I think it may be worth, you know, getting a little tighter handle. Like, for example, you know, as we proceed with the D4 here, you know, maybe talking to Randy Mason and saying, you know, what other additional things are you doing on this deal to make sure in an uncertain time that we have a higher degree of certainty of deal success? And that might give us more financing confidence, you know, showing that we are going to that next level, as we look across our professionals who we know are all adding additional things. And why don't we try to include that, more of that, and give all of our commissioners a little more of a feel on that. Maybe we can even put a checklist in there of things that, you know, used to be expected, and here are new things that are being added to it, to just make sure that we've got, you know, you've got your checklist, but we don't always, you know, the board doesn't always get to see those things. You know, they don't get to see the chalk wall or the marker wall that Suzanne's got in her office, and the spreadsheets that you have. That might just be helpful as we walk into this, because this won't be the last deal, and there's going to be some great opportunities, I think. But if we can't make folks feel confident that we can do them safely, I think that'll be a challenge. So it's incumbent on us to do that.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I certainly we can provide that. Absolutely.
Okay. One thought that I have, and we've talked about this in the past, as we have multiple transactions with one developer partner, and we have several with LDG, because, and they've been a really good partner of ours. We have no reason to believe that they are not going to continue to be a good, solid, dependable, honest partner of ours. In the past, we've talked a bit about how many transactions we have with them, and then how many other transactions or projects that LDG has going on across the country. I would like us to take, as we move forward with this, I would like us to take a look at LDG's financial strength again. What do they have out there in the way of guarantees? Do we feel comfortable that if the road continues to be really, really rocky for a period of time, that the guarantees and what LDG has said to us that they can actually execute on?
I think that's really wise. And let Ron and I think about what that looks like. Ron, I wouldn't even be opposed to, you know, asking, perhaps Novogradic or someone to, split the cost and let them go in and do some kind of a review, just to give us, a little more of a, it's been a little while since we've done that check. And I think it might be worth just going and doing an additional check, there, given kind of the uncertainty of the market.
I'll just add on, it was a topic of discussion with Suzanne and I and Chris and Justin, just as a matter of fact, just about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, when we were still kicking the steel around, and they have more than offered to share their financial capabilities and are extremely transparent, open for us and to provide whatever we want. And that came from Chris. So I don't think it's going to be an issue or a problem to have them, and they understand it. You know, they understand the questions that Suzanne and I asked about the financial strength and the guarantees, and they were more than amicable to say, sure, I'll share that with everybody, no problem at all.
Well, let's see if they'll go and
go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I'm sorry, ma'am. Go ahead.
I would definitely want us to have seen that, have a level of comfort before we move to the next step on this, which I guess is purchasing the land. Is that the next step? When is closing scheduled? Assume this moves forward.
We're already committed.
We're looking at it. We're looking at the middle of May.
Middle of May.
Yeah. The whole transaction will happen at once.
Okay. And I know we talked about this the other day, but like Chuck says, I've slept since then. We own the land. Is that right?
Correct.
We will. Yes, we will own the land. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We will own the land. It will be in the
house. All happening at one time. Okay. Okay. And that all happening at one time anticipated date is like the middle of May. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Are there other discussion, any questions from the commissioners? Any more discussion you all want to have on the resolution 157, authorizing these various actions related to Moonlight Garden? One thing I'm pretty excited about on this development is we have 216 two-bedroom and three-bedroom units, and those units most likely are going to have children. And for us to be in this school district or this area that has this highest six-star TEA rating, I mean, this is really, really significant for educational opportunities for the residents and the children who will be living in this development. So I wanted to get that on the record. Anything else from the commissioners? Okay. If not, and we have asked for any comments from the public. Is that correct? Okay. Then I would like to ask for a motion to approve resolution 0157 from the Board of Directors of Austin Affordable Housing Corporation.
I so move.
Second by Commissioner Ritchie.
All righty. Thank you, Chairman Ritchie, Mr. Ritchie. Any more discussion on the item? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The motion passes. Thank you very much. And thank you, Ron and Suzanne. I know how much work has gone into this development, or this proposed development, this presentation. So good work on your part. I do want to see, Mike, how would you think that we should provide information on LDG?
I think after we get done with the board meeting, Ron, Suzanne, and I will talk and come up with a proposal of what we want to see. And then I think we'll come back to you to verify that you're comfortable with it. We'll run it by perhaps Commissioner Bailey as well to make sure that he's comfortable with it. And then we may also ask Bill and others for insights or things that they would like to see. And then, much like we give you this one pager, of all of our properties with a kind of a broad overview, I think we can create another one pager for each deal, where you get to see maybe a little bit more of the, steps that we've taken sort of deal by deal, but we can go in and do an analysis of LDG. I'm not sure I think we'd want to probably talk to Bourbon Hopkins as well, but I think we need to get someone in there who's going to be able to see the entire thing. So, maybe it's Resnick, maybe it's Novogradac, maybe it's Berman, but someone who, has the skills to do the kind of, overview audit and financial comfort review that we need to get. I think we can come up with a framework for that. And LDG can pay for it because they value the partnership with us. So if it costs them, it's just the cost of doing business. You've got to shore organizations up on what you, your capabilities. And they've done that and they've been very responsive. And Ron, I don't think they'll have any problem with that. Would you agree?
Yeah, I don't think so. And don't forget they've conducted their own audit. I mean, they've got a very, very substantial audit process that they go through that they may want to just share with us to start anyway. So let's just see what we can work out. But I don't think they're going to have any problem with anything. They've already communicated that to me. So.
Yep. So we'll work from there.
Thank
Madam Chair, I don't think we have a need for an executive session or for a any reports. So we would suggest adjourning the AHC meeting.
Okay. Do I need to ask for a motion to adjourn the meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, and this is Commissioner Ritchie. I move that we adjourn the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I second that motion.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, motion carried, and the meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation is closed. Thank you.
And Nydia, they adjourned at 2:14. So we go back now to the HACA agenda, and Chair Ritchie. takes over on number six. And item six is resolution number 02647 by the Board of Commissioners of the Housing Authority of the City of Austin to take the following actions with regard to Moonlight Garden in Austin, Texas. A, acquire the site for development. B, lease the development site to the owner of the development. And C, such other actions necessary and convenient to carry out this resolution. Chairman Ritchie, after public comment, we would suggest a motion.
All right. Is there anyone from the general public who would like to speak on this item? Hearing none, the chair will entertain a motion to approve the item that's before us. There's a motion made by Commissioner Duncan Hall, seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. Was there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Great. Mr. Chair, there's not a need for an executive session today. Next items up are my report, which I think in general I've provided to you regarding our extensive efforts on COVID-19, which have been sort of all-consuming. I will share with the board that just a couple of things. One is that every Monday and Thursday, Sylvia and I and others are participating in the CLAFA industry-wide meeting. This is the Council of Large Public Housing Authorities, the 150 largest public housing authorities in the country. And that's been a particularly helpful call in learning about things that are happening around the country and issues and challenges that our colleagues in harder hit areas are confronting. Routinely, the heads of the Seattle Housing Authority and the heads of the New York City Housing Authority and housing agencies from the Northeast and Pacific Northwest are on the call. So that's been useful in kind of anticipating different issues and thinking about things in different ways. NARA, which we've all been so active in, the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, which has a broader membership, is holding calls every Tuesday and Thursday. The Thursday call and the for NARO and the Thursday call for CLAFA conflict, but our staff team divides up and we're able to listen in on all those industry calls. So we're actively participating in them and contributing. In fact, 2 weeks ago, Sylvia and I spoke about work we were doing on cost accounting for the cost of COVID-19 as we as an agency move forward, how we're keeping track of those costs, how we're coding things, and did a briefing for industry colleagues. So we're active in those national industry discussions. In some of the calls that we've been having, we are anticipating that at some point housing authorities will receive additional tenant-based rental assistance. We don't know what that looks like. Currently, most of that funding is going through cities, and cities will have the choice of how to distribute those dollars. We're not sure that those are dollars that necessarily we're not sure that we have a role to play. It seems like many of those dollars are limited, and they're targeted to very special populations like the homeless or to persons with housing opportunities for people with AIDS. And other specialty programs. So we have not seen any big tranches of vouchers coming through, which has been a source of help for communities following the natural disasters along the Gulf. In fact, our agency administered Katrina Disaster Housing Assistance Program vouchers, or KDHAP vouchers, for quite some time, and actually continues to do so. We also helped administer what are called it's Disaster Housing Assistance Program, or DHAP, and then the DHAP Ike vouchers after Hurricane Ike. We're anticipating some kind of DHAP COVID-19, but we don't know what that looks like. As an agency, we've been in touch with Congressman Doggett's office, and we've encouraged Congressman to be support, and with our senators, we've encouraged as much additional funding for the voucher program, because we have, you know, huge wait lists of people, as much additional funding can come through the voucher program as possible. You know, that's just a win for our community and a win for our agency, and so desperately needed at this time to help people who are being displaced. I will also share with you that we are also, seeing from HUD nationally an unbelievable number of waivers being made available to housing authorities. There was a 62 or 65 page waiver notice that came out that basically waived 80% of the rules that HUD has governing public housing authorities. While I have a personal opinion about it, my professional opinion is that it's something that we will look at and see how those waivers fit with our business needs, and if we need to take one, we will take one. But as it stands right now, we don't feel the need to exercise huge portions of the waiver authority that is being made available. You know, we don't need extensions on our audits. We don't need extensions on submitting our strategic plans. We don't need extensions on submitting our annual plans. We're trying hard to keep the trains running. And if we need extensions, we at that point may claim them. But at this point, we don't feel like we need a lot. Lisa, in Housing Choice Vouchers, however, will likely take advantage of various waiver authority, waivers of the ability to go in and get somebody into a unit and not wait to do a HQS inspection, or the ability to waive the physical inspection and do a virtual inspection. Those types of things. But we are working our way as a staff team through this 60 plus page waiver document. On a personal note, I'll just say, if they can do 60 pages of waivers, it's like everything could be waived. And so, the door's open to even more waivers. So it's an interesting time, for public housing authorities to achieve new flexibilities. And maybe there's some opportunity in that, because clearly housing authorities around the country are going to need the ability to, each one's got, we have very different workforce programs here and very different educational programs here than they do in Dallas or Houston or in any other part of the country. It's just things are unique to the makeup of our city, how we've prioritized spending in the past, the types of programs, nonprofit partners that we have. So with all of that, there may be some opportunities for additional flexibilities that we'll want to tap into. We'll come back and we'll visit with the board about that as we move forward. But we are pushing, Lisa and in her role as chair of the housing committee for NARO, me being active in CLAFA and in NARO, Sylvia as well, and I know Carl's been on many of those calls also, pushing for the maximum flexibilities, because we're all going to need them on the backside of this. Even though we feel like, at this point, thank goodness we're in a little better spot than some of our colleagues around the country, and we'll hope we'll certainly hope and pray that continues to be the case, but even still, we're seeing impacts in our community, and the flexibilities can be helpful. So that's the second thing I'll say about just sort of COVID-19 and our engagement at the national level. The third thing that I wanted to share is that we are not missing a beat on continuing with important work that we've got here at the agency. You heard a lot about several months ago when our auditors came about different policies that we need to update. These include everything from petty cash to our capitalization policy, investment policies, travel reimbursement policies, internal control policies. Starting next month, we're probably going to propose to you all to go ahead and convene the Finance and Administration Committee that you formed at the last board meeting, just to start going through some of those policies. We've got six of them that are proposed, and so we will likely ask you to take up three of them in that committee setting, give you a chance to look at them for a month. Let's go and digest them, and then come back and actually approve them at the June meeting. So review them in committee in May, get feedback, and then come back in June and actually approve them. And then in June, we'll also bring three, the final three policies. We've got six total, so we'll do three in May, review them in committee, then approve them finally in June, and then we'll take the other half in committee in June, and then approve them finally in July. So that's the just a heads up that there's going to be some spade work to be done for the finance and audit committee related to our financial control policies, and I wanted to just make sure folks were clear on that. Beyond that, are there any questions about that? Okay. The last thing I wanted to ask about as most of you know, we continue to support our team members. We're doing regular Wednesday calls that I think have been solid. We've got 230 staff members joining on those calls. I'm grateful that Carl has joined in on those calls several times. I'm hopeful that others of you will join in on those calls. I think Commissioner Carrington's going to join in next week. It's helpful for staff to hear an encouraging word, and so feel free any Wednesday at 11 o'clock to listen in. We try to report on positive things that are happening and then challenges we're struggling with. And so we try to just sort of deal openly and honestly with all the various things happening at the agency. And at least once a week, we're all together. And I think that's important. Even though we're far apart in many cases, we're still able once a week to come back together. So it's all hands on deck meeting. I would like to ask, I'm not prepared to ask for it today, but I'd like to ask for your consideration, in this difficult time, we do know of team members who have family who have lost jobs, who have their job continues. There's a lot of gratitude for ensuring that team members feel safe and confident in their jobs, for at least 90 days. And we started that 90 days when the stay in place order kicked in 3 weeks ago. So we've got another 70 days, to go. And our sense as a management team was we're going to know a lot more in 3 months than we know today. And so let's just kick the ball down the calendar a bit and see where we get. What I wanted to just identify is two more quick things and then I'll let you go. One is that, we are working hard to reposition any staffer who is not able to do their jobs, inspectors, certain maintenance staff. We've got folks who do management and occupancy reviews, and other folks who do work in Michael Cummings' shop. Those folks are being reassigned, and they are being assigned to generally a combination of four projects. We've got them either on helping to address challenges and issues that we've got, with finance. They're on the finance, helping the finance team. They're on a tenant ledgers team, which is being spearheaded by Michael Roth to help correct and address tenant ledger issues. We've got a Go Live Yardi team, which is doing extensive work to help us make that transition to that new technology platform. And then we've got a Jobs Plus Earned Income Disallowance team to go and look at JPEID, which has not always jived, has not always synced up. When we went to RAD, JPEID is a public housing program. It is not synced up well with RAD, and the result is that there's some, again, discrepancies. And so it's just a matter of people going through ledgers and reporting and working through it. So we've got four solid projects that people are working on, and then there's a number of kind of cats and dogs. So I wanted you to know that people are working in earnest on a variety of different projects. Any questions about that? Let me stop there. Okay. So the last thing that I wanted to say related to all of that is that we do know of team members who have spouses or partners who have lost jobs, who are struggling and hurting. Typically, this board has at the end of August or end of July has made the decision to go and approve a $500 bonus check to every team member for the tax-free weekend. Sylvia and I believe that, and sorry for lack of heads up, Commissioner Ritchie, usually I give him the heads up on these things, but Sylvia and I were talking just a short while ago, and we found out about some other folks who are struggling. Our thought is that might be something that might be a little more helpful now rather than just forego it in July. And so I wanted to put that forward to y'all and just get your sort of general sense of, but we know of some folks who I think some cash on hand might be helpful. And I know they're getting it through the stimulus, but I think that might be another avenue in support of being in support of them as an agency as well. So I'd like to put that forward to y'all, and if anyone has any concerns or objections, you know, to that, to let us know. That is something that Sylvia and I, of course, would not take. But that would be for the, you know, a benefit for the rest of the staff team.
What will be the cost of that?
I'm sorry?
Kyra, what will be the cost of that?
Oh, it tends to be about $140,000, $150,000 by the time we're done, because we wind up paying all the taxes on it.
Okay.
And it was something we were most likely going to do at the end of August anyway? Is that
correct? We would have proposed it to you for July, because we would have done it at the weekend. It would hit for the tax-free weekend in August, and be a benefit to folks for that weekend. And usually we do it, yeah, that's when we do the company pickback, and that happens in early August. So yes, we would have pitched it to you probably late June or early July, but our sense is that there's some folks who could really probably benefit from it now.
So let me ask Wilson. Wilson, since this is not really posted on the agenda, can we take action on it? And I'd throw this out to Chuck as well.
Say that again.
So I think this would be an item it would not be an action item. It would just be just to notify you of my intent as your CEO to take that action. But I wanted to make sure that we, and I think I do have that ability to take that action. But before I did it, it would come to you in a budget amendment down the road. You'd see it, but I would want to make sure that, you know, just as more getting a general sense from you all about something like that.
I'm fine with it.
I am too.
Kyle. Me too. I am also.
Okay. Wilson, did I break too many laws?
No, that's generally how we do it.
I hope the answer is no.
Right.
Thank you. I may follow up with one or two of you about it as well, but I thank you very much for that. That gives me a good sense of where to go, and I appreciate it. And we'll just kind of keep that close to the vest for right now until we're ready to share that with staff. But I think the board would be, it'll once it happens, it'll be well received, as it always is for the board. I think the timing is good. Mr. Chair, I don't have anything else for today. I thank you all for your time and patience in walking through this.
Thank you.
All right. Does anybody else have any other matters that they want to bring before the board, or as commissioners bring to the board's attention?
Oh, I had one other thing. I thought Mike.
Go ahead.
Mike, you asked me about Zoom. Are we still thinking about that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Say that again, sir.
He asked, "What are you thinking about Zoom?" And I imagine you are, so that the next time I make a kind of facetious comment, that you can see that I was smiling and that I was not questioning your integrity or the integrity of the staff, but was merely making a comment to help prove a point, so that Chuck wouldn't begin to cross-examine you. I think if we can see each other's faces, we can kind of see the levity in the situation. But when you're just doing it by phone, it's kind of hard to pick it up.
It'd be more fun to on video see my head pop off my neck. So yeah, thank you.
That means we have to dress and put on makeup and do our hair and.
Is there a general sense from the board of so video is an option for us on the GoToMeeting platform, and so we would have the capacity to do that. How do you all feel about it? I guess one of the questions I would ask is who is for those of you who maybe don't use video regularly, and I know some of you don't, are you comfortable with it, and we probably need to get you up to speed just to do a run through before we actually hit the actual board meeting day. You also need to have a webcam on your computer.
I don't have one.
Okay. Yeah, I'm
covering the camera. I mean, some computers have built-in cameras.
Right. Did Commissioner Afsola, did you say you don't have one on your computer?
Yes.
And Haka would be able to provide one to you. And Commissioner Duncan Hall?
Same case.
So if helpful to you, we could try to provide one to you. I think there's just some logistics issue for safety to be able to go and actually train on how to work it. But let me ask Andrea to maybe try to help on that. She's got a few web cameras. They're about $100 right now. She's telling us, and so we can. Let's look at that and see what we can do to. But it may be a hard time to introduce new technology. But let's see where we get.
And I just kind of interject. I mean, my laptop has a built-in camera, but last week I got on Amazon and I bought a webcam for my desktop. And you're right, Mike. They cost $100, and evidently they're pretty easy to install.
This sounds great.
This is something you're definitely considering for the next board meeting, then the Zoom meeting.
Well, I would propose that we wait till the next meeting. The next meeting right now is scheduled for May 21st. If we wind up going after May 21st, I think we should definitely give serious thought to the video approach. But I would say, realistically, between now and the next month, I'm not seeing that a lot of the social distancing stuff and other things that we need to do is going to be eased up. And I think we ought to just err on the side of caution right now. So let's get through the May 21st meeting on just a regular conference call, if everyone's comfortable with it. And then if we still are in the spot in June, then for the June 16th meeting, we'll do that one or June 18th meeting, we'll do that one with GoToMeeting and try video. Would that be okay?
Sure.
That would work pretty good. Because I'm doing a lot of calls either in Zoom. The other one that you could use is Uber Conference, which is a free service as well. And then, obviously GoToMeeting. But those are the three that are pretty the one thing about using Zoom, I would have to say this, is that we would have to share a password to get in with the general public. And so somebody gives somebody an opportunity, and Andrea, you can jump in. But I think when you give the password up publicly, like we have to do public postings, then it gives somebody that can come into to basically take over your conference, as some teachers have experienced with them teaching students through Zoom and then somebody hijacking the class for a few minutes, trying to be huge.
Right.
But that would be one thing that we would need to think about, because we do, since this is a public meeting, you could do, again, Uber Conference. It allows you to have pictures, see each other face to face, but also you get to just have your picture there. And then I think it has a little bit more security, but you ought to get with Andrea to just sort of think through the security issue so we don't have somebody taking over our meeting.
She's on, and she's been we're able to text as we kind of go through this, and she's been indicating that you know, one of the great things about GoToMeetings, which is what we've been using as a platform, has been that we really control everything. So when the inevitable, you know, person comes on and they're, you know, they've got the, you know, the lawnmower going on behind them, we can you know, put them, you know, all calls on mute. We have a lot more control, and it's worked well for us in the larger calls that we've been, you know, doing, you know, here. We do have that video capability, but I think for right now, yeah, and the truth is, Carl, I mean, you and Chuck are, you know, working, each day, and you need that capability. For most folks, you know, it's going to take a little bit of a ramp up, and so, and not being able to actually physically be able to go in and show anybody how to use it, may be a little bit of a challenge. So let's hang on for, I'd say if we can, let's hang on for May. If this continues into the summer, we'll figure out a way to get Mary and Tyra, you know, a webcam and get them up and running, which would be fun to do. But, you know, it'd be more fun to actually just all be able to meet back here at the central office and see y'all. We miss y'all, and this is not a fun way to do a meeting. So, but we'll figure out the technology piece.
Okay.
Sounds like a winner.
Okay.
With that, if there are no more comments, the chair will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Mike moves. Yep.
Okay.
Motion made by Commissioner Carrington, seconded by Commissioner Apostello. Is any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries, and we're officially adjourned at 2:41 p.m. on Thursday, April 16th. Everyone stay safe and stay germ-free.
Thank you. Yeah.